Okay.
So,
you recording?
I am, but I gotta get laid back down. I gotta turn off all the lights again.
Oh no!
Well, I didn't do it last time. I forgot, and I remembered, and it's amazing. So, this is nice. This would seem weird, I think, to an outside observer.
Probably. It's weird enough as it is.
I'm just laying in my bed talking to myself.
are we on 8? Is that what we're on? 8?
Is this 8?
I think it's 8.
Gosh. My gosh, we're too seasoned. We can't even remember how many we've done.
Okay. So are we ready?
Sure.
All right. Welcome to the 8th episode of the Expansion Pack.
Welcome.
My name is Greg Rogers.
And I'm Owen Cook.
Yet again. We are your hosts for this wonderful little podcast.
Yet again.
This week, we're going to be fairly video game light, focused more on movies. We'll be talking about some video game related stuff toward the end. The two big things we're going to be talking about are two movies that recently came out. The first being Wreck-It Ralph, and the second being Skyfall.
The new James Bond movie, Dylan Craig, for those who are unaware.
And then we're going to talk a little bit, not a whole lot, but we're going to talk a little bit about Disney acquisition of Lucasfilms, just kind of a short opinion on that. And then we'll round things up on the web miniseries Forward Unto Dawn.
Mm-hmm. Supposed to be pretty good. Pretty good. Halo 4, that is supposed to be pretty good, that's what I'm saying. Even though it's already out, but I haven't played it yet. You know,
you will.
I will.
This next week.
I plan on it. Okay, so, alright, so, I mean, what did you think of Wreck-It Ralph?
Coming into Wreck-It Ralph, I knew I was excited to see it, just because it was video game based. Mm-hmm. For those who don't know, Wreck-It Ralph, it's not a Pixar film, but it's a Disney animation film, and, it's kind of done the same style. And it's essentially about this fictional video game character called Wreck-It Ralph, and he's in this game called Fix-It Felix Jr., and it's very similar to Donkey Kong that.
About similar to Donkey Kong as they can probably get away with without.
Yeah, where Ralph is up top, you know, wrecking stuff, throwing stuff down, and Fix-It Felix is the kind of the Mario character kind of jumping up. And he plays, you know, the bad guy, but he gets to a point where he's tired of being the bad guy, and it's kind of the journey of him going from kind of discovering himself and other characters and stuff like that.
The movie it's kind of like Toy Story mixed with what am I trying to say? Nightmare Before Christmas, actually. Premise I didn't actually really expect that. And so, as soon as the arcade closes or whatever, all the video game characters, they kind of, you know, they stop acting and they just go back to sort of living their lives in their own games. And then they also, can travel through the power cords to other games.
Yeah.
And things like that.
It's cool. I knew I wanted to see it just because of that, because it was a pretty, you know, unique idea, it looked like. But I was unsure of how good the story would be.
Right.
And so I came in, and after watching it actually really exceeded my expectations, because I felt like I enjoyed the general, you know, Disney/Pixar style, you know, story, and I felt like this one had one of the better animated stories that I've seen. I was really impressed, because coming in I thought that how spoilerific are we going to be?
I mean, it's sort of lighthearted, so I feel like we can probably...
Okay. Maybe we won't, give away, the end or major plot points, but...
Yeah, I mean, the ending... There's no reason for us to spoil sort of major plot points, but...
Right. I came in expecting it to be all about Ralph, because that's what the trailers made it seem like.
Right.
And the other main character, which is not Fix-It Felix, but is Vanellope von Sweet...
Sweets.
I came in only from the trailer. I expected her to be a very minor character, but she ended up being kind of, you know, the sidekick character.
Well, I mean,
to Ralph,
maybe more
of a main character.
Maybe based on the trailer, that could have been. But she's voiced by Sarah Silverman, and I mean, you're not gonna kind of blow those funds on
right.
on somebody relatively minor. So I sort of figured that she was going to be a bigger deal than.
But she was a bigger, that character was a bigger deal than I was expecting, and so that kind of that surprised me when it came to the story.
Yeah,
and the fact that, you know, I liked her that character a lot, and the dynamic between her and Ralph.
Right. Yeah, I think
really is what made the film for me. So
Sarah Silverman and John C. Reilly, who does the voice for Ralph, I think did a brilliant job. I think it was really well done. Really,
yeah,
well.
And we'll talk about this a little bit later. But for the Vanellope von Schweetz character in particular, the animation on her face exuded a lot of emotion. Like, yeah. They did an extremely good job in catching the nuances of that.
I mean, animated films of late, like, ever since Toy Story, really, was sort of set a precedent for that kind of thing, I think, in terms of standard, what you'd expect in terms of sort of emotional content in animation. Ever since then, the animated films of that nature have improved exponentially with each iteration. So, like, every single film gets better and better and better along those lines.
Right.
To where now I think it's really, truly impressive how they managed to make it so sort of likable and high quality and all that sort of thing, but then also not in the uncanny valley. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
They do a lot of sort of fine line dancing there, and I think they've people who work in that industry have gotten exceptional at it.
Yeah. So before we actually go into more of the movie and the story itself, one thing, like I said, coming in, I knew it was going to be about video games. But especially when it comes to something that you're going to draw a crowd, you know, no matter how good it is, just by having that theme. And one thing I felt like the movie did really well was its video game references that it made were very offhand, and it didn't shove them down your throat. And a lot of them there were several that, or two or three that someone mentioned to me. It may have been you. It was someone else. Like there's one that says, Aerith Lives is like graffitied on the side of in the Grand Central, the Game Central Station. I didn't even notice that.
Yeah,
just little things here and there where, they don't. All the main characters in the story are fictional games. They're not real games. So they fit within tropes. Like the Wreck-It Ralph is the, you know, the Donkey Kong, like the very classic. You know, the Hero's Duty is obviously poking fun at both Gears of War and, you know, Call of Duty by name.
Right.
You know, you have, you know, the kart racers and stuff like that. Like all they fit into these game tropes, but the characters in them are fictional, made up for the purpose of the movie. But one thing that jumped out to me in particular was just the authenticity of the arcade cabinets, that every single arcade game that was not made for the purpose of the story were actual arcade cabinets. Like, right. The one that jumped out to me in particular was the Star Wars one that has like fully encased you. It was like, right. The wireframe one where you fought the Death Star, and it was, I don't know. That really, for people who had played video games for a long time, going into watching that movie, there was a lot of subtle things that made that movie
What I'll sort of say about it. I think we've probably said this exact thing almost every time we've talked about movies, but subtlety in films is usually done pretty terribly. We talked about this quite a bit when we talked about Bourne Legacy in like our first episode. But in the way that you handle subtlety correctly, whenever you're trying to make a reference to something, this is like, referential humor is like my thing. I fucking love references. They're absolutely my favorite the sort of entertainment in just everything, in video games or movies or TV shows or anything like that. Whenever you're trying to make a reference, the people who are going to get the reference are going to get it, even if you're really very subtle with it. Like, you don't have to say what the name of something is in order for somebody to get it. If you just, you know, if you know enough about the product that you're trying to reference, the product or IP or whatever, then you can make a very offhanded comment and then people will catch it. Something like Aerith Lives, right? Like, everybody who played Final Fantasy VII is going to understand what that means. Absolutely every single person.
Right.
Exactly what that means instantaneously. Now, if you were to take that a step further in the film and then explain what that's about, right? If you say anything about Final Fantasy VII by name, or if you say anything else about it, then it's too much, because now the people who got it already got it, and the people who aren't going to get it don't give a shit. Like, well, and they just don't. And so then you're sort of wasting screen time by explaining them what the reference is when they don't get it, so it's not important, right?
Sure.
And I think Wreck-It Ralph does an excellent job of. I think it's one of the. It's a film that stands out to me as rather than trying to tap into the arcade you know, arcade gamers or the gamer sort of aesthetic. What it's trying to do is it's made by people who are familiar with those sort of things, and they're still just trying to make a Toy Story-esque kind of like kids movie, but they want to put things in it that they find entertaining or things that the parents of the kids who take them to see those films, they will get them. So referencing stuff like Centipede and all that kind of stuff, like anybody who gets that is going to be over 20 years old now.
Right.
And so they're all going to be taking their kids to see the film. So the film is not about about video games in that sense. It's not about arcades in that sense. It's just a kids' film that uses that setting in order to entertain the parents also. And that's, I mean, that's something that I feel like all the sort of Pixar, Disney animated films, stuff like Monsters Incorporated and things like that, they've always been kids' films, but they've always done a truly brilliant job of making sure that there's enough content to keep the parents entertained also.
I feel like that's a good staple of just animated things in general, because the quintessential one that's coming to mind is Looney Tunes.
Sure.
I mean, the old school Looney Tunes, you could say those were targeted at kids, but, you know, it had lots of nuance as far as, you know, different things that the kids wouldn't get but parents would get.
Sure.
And I feel like that carries through in what makes good animated films or good, I understand that you are correct whenever you say that it's targeted at children, but I feel like good animated films are more universally, you know, they can be viewed and appreciated on a universal scale, which is what you're saying.
Right. No, yeah. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Because I definitely appreciate, you know, the story and the characters of Wreck-It Ralph.
Right. And the fact that it's a video game centered world actually doesn't even matter that much. The fact that it's a video game centered world, you know, appealed to me and the sort of things that I'm interested in, right? Being somebody who plays video games a lot and who's been part of that culture for a long time. But I think anybody who even wasn't part of that sort of culture or identity or anything like that can still enjoy the movie very thoroughly.
Yeah.
Even not understanding, you know, like when he's in the meeting for villains and Bowser is sitting there, Bowser doesn't say anything.
Yeah.
And no one ever mentions who he is. Like, he's just there in the little circle. He's just sitting there. And so it's like everybody who will get that reference already got it. So there's no reason to go. There's no reason to say anything about it more. There's no reason to mention it. And I think, you know, they did that pretty much perfectly throughout the entire film. I can't remember any specific instances and where I was like, okay, that was a little overt. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I agree. I feel like that they did.
The Konami code was kind of pushing it, but
they didn't like exactly say. I mean, it's funny that he had it written down and he had to. I mean,
right? No, I mean, I think for the most part, it was pretty brilliant. I mean, even times like the Konami code where it's kind of like, you're treading close to the sun there. It's like, okay, that's fine. I mean, it still isn't overt, and I'm, you know, probably being sort of nitpicky at that point. Especially because, like, I've been so satisfied up till that point that I was like, all right, like, surely they're going to screw up at some point, right? So I'm like, ah! Konami code, you did it. You have, like, a NES controller and everything. Like, ah! So, you know, I think Wreck-It Ralph does an excellent job, and sort of subtlety and reference humor and all that kind of things, Wreck-It Ralph is almost an exemplar of that.
Go to wreck it!
Of execution. Because so many movies and so many games and so many TV shows and things just fuck it up so bad. And it's like, I don't know, it frustrates me because that's the kind of humor that I think I probably enjoy the most.
Yeah. Before we move, I want to talk about like the subtlety in animation, but since we were talking about voice actors earlier, they did an excellent job of casting for this film.
Yeah.
Not just in like the main characters of, Alan Tudyk.
Yeah.
I felt like that was, I mean, he did a great job with King Candy and Jack McBriar. I don't feel like you could choose anyone besides Jack McBriar to play Fix-It Felix Jr.
It's like, I don't know. It's a little bit of a shame that Fix-It Felix Jr. might as well be, what is even his name?
Kenneth.
Yeah, Kenneth. Okay. It was like Kenny? No, that's not right. No, okay. So Kenneth, like, it's a little bit of a shame that it's exactly the same character. You know what I mean?
But then it works.
But it's fine because it works in that context, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. So I think it was a good selection. I just wish, I hope that McBride has some sort of more dynamic range. I'd be interested to see. Well, I mean, he was certainly typecast in that role. I just mean like,
oh, sure.
I'm interested to see if he's capable of being not typecasted. Because, like, Bruce Willis, for example, not really very capable of playing anybody but John McClane. And so, you know, I'd be interested to see him kind of sort of maybe branch out. But I do agree that I think the voice acting and the casting in general was
yeah. I mean, I think that probably
good.
Sarah Silverman was probably my favorite.
Yeah, I was really surprised because Sarah Silverman is kind of an acquired taste, especially in her comedy and things like that.
Oh, definitely.
So, I mean, when I saw that she was part of the cast, I was kind of like, eh. I don't really know how that's going to work, but we'll see. I think she did an excellent job.
She did an excellent job of not, I mean, I feel like she took a step outside
what she normally does.
Right. Yeah, what she's known for, what she normally does, and I feel like she pulled it off really well. Going back to, I mean, just all these nuances of using this video game theme to not, be the focus of what, the story was necessarily about, but it used it to bring life to the world. And two things that jump out to me immediately were just the different styles of animation used to tell or used to characterize people. Like, for example, the people in the high rise in the Fix It Felix Jr.
Yeah,
like they moved, you know, at five frames per second.
Right. Yeah. I like how they sort of cut frames out of the animation to make him look.
Yeah, and it was great. And then whenever he smashed, Ralph smashes the cake, and everyone gets splattered with the cake goo.
Yeah, it's all Annie Alias.
It's pixelated. It's pixelated. It's really cool. And I'm trying to think of one more that comes to mind. For example, in the bad guy meeting, the ghost, the orange ghost, he only moves.
Yeah, they only move up and down, side to side.
Up and down, side to side. Yeah, just little things like that that take what you know about the video game, and they don't just scream it at you, but it's there, and it adds so much more whenever you put things into a greater context.
That's what I meant when I said that what's nice about Wreck-It Ralph is that it's clearly made by people who are familiar with that stuff. But they aren't making the film. They're drawing from what they know. You know, obviously, one of the sort of tenets of writing is you sort of write what you know, right?
Yeah.
I just said write, four different times, but with each, different use of it, different spelling.
Excellent.
Anyway, and so it's not marketed towards people who are going to get video game references, so they're not trying to tap into that market, which is where a lot of things fail. This is the reason that Uwe Boll will never make a movie worth a shit, okay? That's because he's just I don't know if I said this on here, but I read an interview specifically one time where this is before I'd ever watched anything that Uwe Boll had ever done, right? So I just heard he, got a bad rap or whatever for making shit movies, and so I was reserving judgment because I hadn't seen any of his films myself, so I couldn't make... I had no basis other than sort of that the internet hated him. And I saw an interview where somebody was like, so you are pretty well known for making movies that nobody ever likes. Why is that? You always stray from the video game stories and make your sort of own thing that nobody likes. Why do you do that? And he said, video games don't really have much of a story, so sometimes you just gotta kind of make something up. And I was just like, okay, this guy's a fucking moron. it just instantly, this guy has got to be the dumbest... obviously he's done a lot of what he does is kind of trolly, and he's definitely kind of hamming it up, and I think he's an asshole, and that's what makes him money, so he is more of an asshole than he probably actually is. That's the difference between people like Uwe Boll and people who the people who are behind Wreck-It Ralph, is that they're drawing from experience, so that's why the references are funny, because they're not overt. Anybody who gets them is going to get them already. And then the movie is something different. The movie is not about the fact that they're making video game references or right. That set in a video game universe.
They build these tropes, these character tropes, because each one of the main characters is built around a trope of a classic or more modern, video game icon or character. But then they take those tropes and they don't feed into the story of the video game, but they use that starting point to springboard into a story of their own, which I think is a brilliant way of constructing a story it can be around any, theme or context that you want to build it around. But that's a good way of taking something that you want to build a world around and then building a unique story from
right.
it. Yeah.
So, yeah, Wreck-It Ralph was
oh, Wreck-It!
And I definitely recommend it.
Wreck-It.
To anybody and everybody of all ages for any reason. Like, it's one of those films that's not, it's not something that you won't be able to find enjoyment in, no matter, I mean, no matter what you like about movies. Unless you, I mean, you know, unless you're like, oh, I only watch like European, like, you know, kind of hipstery films, then I guess maybe you won't like it because it's kind of generic in a lot of ways. But
one thing that, I mean, before we leave it, I mean, just talking about the plot, I was surprised, like genuinely surprised at how well everything connected in the plot, both thematically and just within the plot arc itself. I'm not gonna, because if I say these things, then that'll be spoiling everything, because it hinges around the different plot turns. But I mean, the theme of him being a wrecker comes back. The theme of him wanting a medal, and like the fact that it is in Hero's Duty, and then that medal has the word hero on it, right. And then you know, the trope of just the difference between being a wrecker and being a fixer. And being one bad and good, but also, I mean, just the plot of like the main villain and how he ends up kind of coming around and everything that kind of, you know, centers around him and his background. And, you know, they keep on saying, you know, I'm not gonna say it because that's gonna give it away. But you know, they mention something in the movie several times, and at first you don't really know what it means, and then eventually they explain to you what it means, and eventually that comes around to mean something grander at the end. That there's no string left untied in the movie, and I was pretty impressed with how tightly the plot was wound together at the end of everything.
Yeah, I mean, it's all around excellent. You know, much I had sort of only mild expectations going into it, and they were blown away.
I did too. I didn't. I mean, I was coming in not expecting as good of a movie as it was. So
sure.
Yeah.
So Ralph, Greg Rogers, Owen Cook recommendation. I think it's pretty good.
Pretty good.
Not sad that I spent $7 on it.
Nope.
Not exactly Citizen Kane. There you go. That's the.
I think you're right.
Not as good as Citizen Kane, not as bad as Birdemic. That's my...
Birdemic?
Have you not heard of Birdemic?
No, I've heard of Birdemic. I've heard about it through JonTron.
Okay, well, you need to watch Birdemic.
I've not watched it. I've got plenty of it from his little thing.
It's so good. Oh, God, that movie's good. Okay.
I think you're right. We don't do a whole lot of stuff that we don't end up endorsing in the end.
Right.
It's not a bad thing.
No, it's not a bad thing.
I don't know.
We criticize things pretty heavily.
Yeah, we do.
I don't know what I like about the show.
We don't try and find the good stuff too, though.
Well, it's because I mean, there's only so much you can say about bad stuff. that was shitty.
Like Sonic's. Well, I guess I'm going to digress here a little bit. I am completely loving the Sonic 06 playthroughs on Game Grumps.
Yeah.
When you talk about, like, there is just nothing to say about the game, there's nothing to say. It's so just bad.
Play it for, like, 10 seconds and you'll understand. Yeah. No, like, I mean, they only had one episode of Game Grumps just recently where they played, like, Rugrats in Paris or something like that. And I'm pretty sure there's only going to be the one episode because, I mean, it's just an awful game. That's, like, it wasn't, I mean, it's like Birdemic bad. It's not even, like... There's just nothing about it. Like, it's not even any good. And so while they were playing it, like 15 minutes into the 20-minute video, they're just like, can we stop playing this? This is awful. Like, Sonic 06 is over there, and I really want to play that right now, because this is really terrible.
Sonic 06 leaps the it's so terrible that you have to stop playing it to it's so terrible that you have to keep playing it. It leaps the valley onto the other side. It's that bad. But,
yeah, no. I mean, what I like about the show is that I feel like what I intend to do sort of is that I feel like a lot of people have this idea about movies and video games and TV shows that you know, like things being good and things being bad is like relatively black and white, where it's like, you know, if something is 4 out of 10 stars, then it's fucking, you know, it's just not that good. It's not even worth your time or whatever. Don't worry about it. But oftentimes, no matter how bad or how good something is, there's always something that you can either say was good about it or say was negative about it. And so what I like about the show is that even though we tend to focus on things that, you know, we've played and have experience with and things that are good and that kind of thing, we still analyze it enough that that justification, you understand every single part of it. You understand how that conclusion came to be beyond just like, well, I just like movies about video games, and you know, I don't know, it's
yeah.
I think we do a pretty good job of that, so I'm not too worried about the fact that we haven't shit on so many things yet.
Right. Yeah.
That, and I mean, you know, it's hard to find things that are really shitty, because even things that are relatively generic
that are genuinely worth of just like no praise at all.
Right. Yeah. I mean, things they don't really make too many things that get much attention that are just bad. Right. Like, yeah. So I don't know. So yeah.
So I guess we're moving on to Skyfall.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'll start off by saying that I thought Skyfall was okay. I'll say that it was better than Quantum of Solace, but worse than Casino Royale.
I'm undecided on that. I feel like that they're on par with each other, but I feel like that they're different.
I'll kind of agree with that. They're different, sure.
Casino Royale took probably the most modern take on Bond that any Bond movie has taken before, especially whenever it was released. It was a huge reboot, and like we had, as far as I can remember, there were no gadgets, it was very streamlined, but the espionage and the spy aspect of it was really good, and it still maintained that kind of James Bond debonair. I mean, they didn't take that out. They still maintained the character, but it kind of dropped him in a different spot. Whereas Skyfall maintained that newness, but a whole theme that goes through the entire movie is synthesizing the old with the new.
Mm-hmm.
And so like sometimes Skyfall it'll make fun of some old James Bond tropes, but other times it will incorporate different things into it. And then the way that the whole movie wraps up is very much a nod and kind of an integration with, you know, old school, you know, classic Bond, James Bond.
Well, sure. I'll say that actually I found that I kind of didn't like that so much, because while the first two films definitely they didn't try to pretend like they were something different than what they are, you know, which is James Bond movies. So there's still a lot of the same sort of thematic reoccurrences and things from the older movies, but there's no gadgets, and they tend to sort of shy away from that sort of thing. So I guess what was weird about this one is I felt like maybe they're just like, we didn't make enough sort of allusions to old Bond things, so now we just have to fucking fill this movie to the brim with them. Like,
sure.
Every other line is just like, oh, boy, you thought we were going to have exploding pens? We don't really do that anymore. Like, I don't know.
I see that as a positive, though. I mean, especially, like, they would take the old stuff and, I mean, with, like, the Q character was still, you know, a Q character, but he was vastly different.
Fucking from, and from... That guy needs to relax. Can he have only one highly anticipated release per month? Does he really need to? is he Thorin Oakenshield? He's not. But
he's not. Wait. What? What? Yeah. What'd you say?
He's not Thorin Oakenshield.
Oh, okay.
From the Hobbit.
Right. No, I know who Thorin Oakenshield is.
He's not any of the dwarves.
Right.
Because I would be like, oh my gosh, that guy needs to relax.
Well, it was kind of like Jeff Bridges with. A couple years ago, he had Tron Legacy and True Grit that released almost back to back. I felt like it still maintained. I mean, the fact that he only received, you know, a palm printed pistol and a radio, you know, kind of maintained that newness I was talking about, but it synthesized it with the old in a way that I personally felt didn't overdo it. The only time that I felt like they were really like thrusting it at you was whenever he got the older car that had the guns and it played, you know, the classic theme. But I felt like that was appropriate at the time.
Well, and it's just like, so I don't know. I just picture them sort of in their screenplay writing, like meeting. They're like, okay, we got to have the ejector seat in there somehow. But Mythbusters already proved that ejector seats don't work. So how are we going to do this? Like, they're like, oh, so we'll just, you know, have him be like, oh, red button. And then it'll be like, oh, ejector seat. And then we'll just close it and then move on to the next scene. So I don't know. I felt like a lot of those things were somewhat unnecessary.
Characterization, though, I mean, it was not necessarily about the ejector seat. It was about the relationship between M and Bond, I felt.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't completely handled terribly. I just mean, like, for me, it got a little bit too much in certain instances.
Yeah.
Like I said earlier about Wreck-It Ralph, everybody knows that it's a James Bond movie. Everybody's already familiar with it. So you don't, it's unnecessary to do it over and over and over again. Like,
sure.
After you say exploding pens, like, everybody gets it. Like,
right.
Everybody got the joke. You don't need to be like, oh, exploding pens, and then also, you know, oh, my name is Money Penny. You know, it's just like, oh, Jesus, okay.
Oh, yeah, but I feel like she's going to come back. And
you think there's going to be more Daniel Craig Bond movies?
Yeah. I do. I mean, even though I know he's not too hot on it, but
I don't think that's it. I think they're done.
You think that's it?
Yeah, they might make more Bond movies. I don't think Daniel Craig will be
the
Bond anymore.
I mean, one thing. I mean, you can't. It's kind of like the whole Mass Effect 3 thing, where you can't bring down a whole project based on the ending.
Sure.
But I feel like the Casino Royale does take a hit, a small hit, by the fact that it leaves off at a cliffhanger that follows directly into Quantum of Solace, which does not have a very satisfactory story.
Sure.
And so, I mean, Casino Royale doesn't have much closure, whereas Skyfall has a pretty satisfying closure. And I feel like Bond is characterized a lot better. I feel like we get to look at him as a person a whole lot more in Skyfall, because we kind of look at his background, but we also look at him finally. He's not the badass. He is a badass, but he struggles with the fact that, you know, he might be getting a little older now.
I think he actually had a little bit of Dark Knight Rises syndrome, where it's like he failed all of his physical evaluations, like, completely. It was a dismal failure in all of them. Yet for some reason he's still able to like hang on to speeding elevators upside down, and then also like survive under frozen lakes for extended periods of time, things like that.
The frozen lake was a little much.
I broke my back, so here, I'll just stretch it out. It's like, now I'm good to go. Yeah. Like, I'm ready to rock. Let's do this.
The frozen lake was a little much, although I felt like they showed him struggling with things like the elevator. Like, I feel like that if he was at his prime, he would have just been, like, you know, badass, like, grabbing it and then pulled himself up. But, you know, they showed that he was having trouble with it, so...
The issue with that is that, you know, if you show him having trouble with it, that's one thing, right? And obviously you need to do that. But, I mean, the fact that he wasn't... So they painted him as not as physically capable as he used to be, but the fact that that never actually, physically actually hindered him in anything that he tried to do, that was somewhat of a drawback. Like, if he had some kind of long fight or something where, like, the guy that he was fighting with just got the upper hand on him and just beat his ass... Because he simply can't keep up anymore. He's, you know, older. Then that would be the proper execution of it. But it's like, oh well, you know, he's not comfortable underneath that lake. It's kind of like, okay, sure, I guess. Like, but you know, he just like he wouldn't. I don't know.
I can see that. I can see inserting.
There's a better way to handle that, I think.
Inserting a scene like, you know, one third to a midway through where he kind of. He fails because of this ineptitude.
Right.
But then he comes back because of, you know, not because necessarily because of purely his physical, you know, capabilities, but, you know, he can do enough with them, but then he uses his smarts to kind of overcome in the end, which I felt like that even though they didn't show that scene, which I agree with you that they could have done that to make it better.
I felt like
he won ultimately in the end not because of his physical prowess. Because of his experience in the field, but
sure. I mean, there's definitely an element of that. But I mean, that's with kind of any element, any movie that I think that has that element of like, oh, you know, protagonist getting older or he's injured in some way. Some like Live Free or Die Hard did this. Dark Knight Rises did this. They're always just like, oh yeah, he's old now, and then they just continue to do what they normally do, and it's just like, well, I don't know. That's you're not. Like, okay, so he's old, so I buy it when you use it as, like, comedic effect, right? Where somebody's just like, oh, hey, you're getting old, Bond, blah, 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 right? And then everybody laughs. Like, that's fine, but from an actual sort of narrative perspective, they're falling very short of the sort of weight that implication could have and should have, based on how they portray it.
Sure, I agree with that.
And that's kind of a shame. And I understand that Live Free or Die Hard is like a dumb action movie or whatever. But Dark Knight Rises is not. I mean, Dark Knight Rises is praised as being more than that when it does a lot of the same dumb shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's I don't know. I feel like I hope that it's a good day to Die Hard, the fifth one, which I cannot fucking wait for. I love it. I hope they make nine more. I hope that Bruce Willis is basically wheelchair bound and still making them. That would be amazing. I hope that in that one, in which he's even like 5 years older than he was in Live Free or Die Hard, I hope that they actually have him sort of unable to do some of the things that he used to do.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that would add a decent amount to it from a narrative perspective.
Yeah. But overall, I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed Skyfall.
Yeah, I liked it.
I was going to say something, but it's slipping away. It is quickly slipping away. One thing I was going to say is just how, I mean, they synthesized the old in, like I was talking about, but very rarely, like I said, the only part that I'm really thinking of that was very, you know, beat you over the head with it was the car, which only briefly was in it to begin with.
Sure.
I felt like that they brought back a very good Bond villain without it making it seem like, you know, this extremely outlandish, like, you know, Dr. No and his island fortress. You know, I feel like they took a classically, you know, Bondish villain, but they inserted him into a position where I could see that being, you know, a realistic, you know, terrorist like character.
Sure. I'll say that Javier Bardem was way the best, did the best acting job in the film out of anybody, I'd say. Even outshining Judi Dench. He did an excellent job. Excellent job as Silver. Or whatever his real name was. It's like Ignatius or something.
I don't even remember. Yeah, I mean, someone was asking me, like, so what's the – I was talking about the villain, and it's like, so what was his name? I was like, I don't remember, but it's not important because that's, you know –
The point is that person is dead. Like that was that.
Yeah, and the point was
that silly.
Thematically, that was the point, and you got across, you know, why he was a villain and what he was doing without necessarily needing to know.
Sure.
His name.
This is something that I'll knock against it, and I guess it's kind of even unfair at this point to knock movies for it because they all do it. So it's like, it's just like, you know, complaining that movies are the way they are, but still. The usage of computers in film is just so fucking ludicrous that it's just out of control. Like, I mean, he's looking at this one point and he's just like, oh, you know, oh my gosh, he's obfuscating his code so that it's, you know, that it's difficult to track, which is like the real one or whatever. It's like, yeah, that's what security is. Why do they even say, and it's just like, oh my God, he's hidden his code behind this fucking dumb iTunes music visualizer. Like, that's not what code looks like. Oh my gosh. It's so frustrating. Because I wish that a movie would sort of do it the way that it would actually be done, where they go to like the tech expert and he's got three monitors with just walls of text on all three of them. He's got maybe like Google open on one and he's like browsing through forums, right?
People yeah.
Oh my gosh, you know, have you figured it out yet? And he's just like, no, it's going to take some time.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say is that I think it would be also a good thing to do to not have them sit down and figure it out in 5 minutes.
Right.
You know, because they always like, you know, type is like, oh, this is this. Oh, I got it.
Right.
Well, you know, why don't we give it to them for a couple days and like let them, you know, always come back to it. I don't know. I mean,
well, I think, you know,
at some point you have to move the plot along, but I feel like sure. you can construct the plot.
Well, but that, I mean, yeah, it's something that you should sort of just take. You just give them whatever element that they need to work on the computer. Just make that more available, like make that information available to your characters earlier in the story so that they then have a realistic amount of time to deal with it. But instead it's all this sensationalized, like, you know, oh, I'm like flying through like Tron 3D space to hack things. It's like, that's so dumb. And then this idea that it's just like, hey, this guy's a brilliant hacker. So he just literally gets to do whatever he wants, like with every system in the whole world. It's like, that's, I don't know. I'm bored of that particular storyline. Like, he's like, oh, I've got, you know, oh, I can hack anything that I ever want. And I'll say that, like, this will be a little bit spoiler. You should, like, mark the time here or something so that we can note this in the chapters. Spoilers for the series Sherlock. You've seen it, right? Have you seen Sherlock?
Yeah, I've seen everything but the final episode.
Oh, really? Oh, well, fuck. All right, never mind. I'll say, okay, well, what I will say is that Sherlock does the same kind of thing, but then does it correctly, more so than a lot of things do it.
Okay. I've seen it through Hound of the Baskervilles, or the Hound of whatever they called it.
The first episode of season two is Hound of Baskerville.
No. The first episode is the one with Irene Adler.
Is it?
Yeah, because it's three episodes and three episodes. Baskerville is the second one.
Yeah. Okay, you're right. So and then the third one is the Reichenbach Fall or whatever.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Do you not have it? It's on like iTunes.
No. I'm well aware. I just don't. I have to like have. You know, because they're so long, I have to have a considerable chunk of time to make myself.
Well, fucking hurry up and watch that. It's good. Okay. I'll just say that one of the sort of major plot twists involves sort of tech things, and I thought they were going to do the same thing that a lot of TV shows and films do, but then they kind of turn it on its head. And shine a light on the fact that that's absurd, like that idea. And I'm like, yeah, like fucking thank you for once, like Jesus Christ. I think. What I'll say about sort of overall for Skyfall, it's not terrible, but there's not many things about it that I think stand out as exceptional. In contrast to Wreck-It Ralph, where there's a lot of things that are exceptional. To me, Skyfall was kind of Casino Royale was significantly better because it did a lot of things that Bond films hadn't tried to do, and it did an exceptional job of making Bond less of a just errant sexist kind of asshole character like he is in all the original, all the original Bond films are all the same basically. And then even in Quantum of Solace and to a lesser extent, Skyfall, he kind of goes back to that. Whereas in the first one, that's not kind of who the character was. And I thought that was,
I would say that Skyfall is a very good Bond movie.
Sure.
But it definitely sticks to, the classic beats of the Bond,
sure. Casino Royale sort of stands apart, I think, from the rest of the Bond franchise. And given that I'm not a huge Bond franchise fan in general, I think that's probably why I like Casino Royale that much more. It's kind of fucking The Dark Knight, as opposed to The Dark Knight Rises or Batman Begins or any of the original Batmans. Like The Dark Knight has the least in common with the rest of those. And that's what I like about it, because I was not a huge fan of what the sort of the bedrock foundations of what the rest of Batman is like was not what I liked about the show or about the IP. And so The Dark Knight kind of straying from those things is what makes it good. And so the same applies to Casino Royale for the Bond franchise for me anyway.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Well, I feel like that's a good look at Skyfall without, just spoiling too much.
Sure. And there's not, unlike Wreck-It Ralph, where I think the twists are handled pretty well, Skyfall doesn't really have that many twists.
No, it's a straight shot.
It's pretty straightforward.
But then again, they don't complicate the plot too much, sure. Which I feel like is something that is positive that, especially in espionage films, things can you can complicate things too much and make things get lost.
Yeah, you can definitely get out of your depth pretty quickly.
Yeah. So I guess we'll move on to the Disney acquisition.
Sure.
For those, I'd be surprised if you don't know, but for those who don't know, about a couple weeks ago, Disney acquired Lucasfilm for some multi-billion number in money.
It's like 4.1 or 4.4.
Yeah. But they not only got Lucasfilm, but they also got Skywalker Sound and Industrial Light and Magic. So they have the whole suite now. And they've announced, of course, that they're going to go forward with episodes at least 7, 8, and 9. They're going to release 7 at the beginning of sometime in 2015, and then the release a Star Wars movie.
2015 might as well be
every 2 years.
It might as well be the rest of all eternity. 2015, like this coming out after Star Citizen, which might as well never be coming out. All
right,
whatever.
Right. And what's really cool is that I read something about kind of Lucas's original.
Stay tuned for the expansion pack first episode of 2015. We'll talk about Star Wars Episode 7.
Right. Where originally he had it marked out into 12 episodes. Like this is back before he had even written the script for Episode 4.
Sure.
But he had it kind of blocked out in 12 episodes, and it was not blocked out the way that it originally was. episode 2 through 4 was designed as to be like a Clone Wars trilogy, where it was not about necessarily about like pre-Clone Wars. I'm guessing that he probably would have focused on Anakin still, but it would have been like during the Clone Wars, which is what he should have done anyways.
Well, there's a lot of things he should have
done. This is not I can talk for a long time about Star Wars, and we're not going to go down that road.
In order to wrap it all up before it even starts, what George Lucas did or would have done, I think, is not that important anymore, given that he's not involved.
Partially involved. He is an advisor. Yeah.
Okay, whatever.
We'll get to that here in a second.
It's not his baby anymore.
No, it is not his baby. And that was the problem of the first three. I feel like he had complete control and everyone was too afraid to question him. Right. So, but like I said, if we're going to have a Mass Effect episode, we might eventually have a Star Wars episode. I don't know. I know you're not a big fan of Star Wars, but I'll let you rant about that here.
I think that would make a Star Wars episode rather intriguing because everybody's
I agree.
A huge Star Wars fan, but fuck Star Wars.
So 2 through 4 was supposed to be like a Clone Wars trilogy. Episode 1 was just supposed to be some kind of, you know, prelogue or prelude or something like that. Did I say prelogue?
You did.
I did. And the original trilogy was supposed to be like 5 through 8, and then 9 through something was supposed to be. I don't remember. So I don't know if they're going to just do these three, or if these three do well, if they're going to go on and do others. Star Wars has
probably kind of reached like, I don't know, almost like Pokemon status at this point, where the IP will never ever die. Like, there's always going to be somebody making some product involved with IP. It doesn't even matter.
Right. But it gets to the point where, you know, the expanded universe of Star Wars is just so massive that I think I said this at one point, that you almost have to
pick
and choose what you want to consider canon. And so part of me really wants to – one of two things. One, I would like to see episodes 7 through 9 take place after 6. You know, just – especially if you're going to name it 7, I feel like it makes sense to continue the story instead of go back.
Yeah, I don't imagine that they're going to
– even though they have plenty of material to go backwards. I actually prefer the Star Wars universe pre – episode 1 to post episode 6. But what this leads me to saying is I really hope they don't feel like they're tied down by the expanded universe.
Yeah, no, I'm glad that you said that, because I was going to say that. I hope that with episodes 7, 8, and 9, I hope they do their own thing completely.
I hope they don't. Right. Don't feel like they have to follow something. I feel like that you know, that the movies have precedent, and so you build a story based on what characters you want to have, and don't worry about, you know,
right,
the other books, which, you know, the story post 6 is not fantastic anyways. I mean, the only thing that is really the praises are really sung for are the I forget what it's called. It's called like the Heir to the Empire trilogy of books. I've never read them, but they're very highly thought of. But other than that, I'm not a big fan of post 6 lore.
I guess I don't know. I don't know a whole hell of a lot about it. I know.
Right. It just,
I know that. I know that. Like other Luke, creatures. Like I know that Luke establishes like a academy or something, and then he's like kind of flying around trying to find force sensitive children or something. I don't know.
Luke. Oh, I thought you said Lucas.
I might have said Lucas. I meant Luke.
But okay. So speaking of Lucas, he is not obviously not writing, but they just announced the writer for 7, which is Michael Arndt, who wrote most notably Little Miss Sunshine and Toy Story 3. So he's going to be writing the screenplay for episode 7. But he is Lucas passed on kind of the mantle of Lucasfilm to another woman named Rebecca something. I don't remember. But they're kind of – those two are kind of have meetings with Michael, and just to kind of – it's kind of like an advisory thing to kind of talk about the story. I mean, I think that Michael probably has ultimate control at like the micro level, but I feel like that George still might lend his input, which – I mean, people give George a lot of shit, and he deserves it for some part of episodes 1 through 3, but then again, this is still the guy who made the original 4, 5, and 6.
Sure.
Who wrote 4, 5, and 6, and I feel like that you still have to credit him for the brilliance of creating this universe. But I mean, I don't know if you have any opinions on this. I was about to go into more about
I definitely do.
Star Wars, but we'll save that because that'll spiral the episode out a lot longer. So
yeah, Star Wars is good, but I think a lot like sort of how I've expressed my feelings about hey, just in this episode Bond, and then also Batman and other kind of things, that these huge expansive universes that people like. I guess you could expand Batman out to be more sort of comic books, sort of in general, like DC and Marvel and things like that, not just Batman. But I tend to not be as fascinated with those things as the general populace, and that's not really to say that they're bad. It's just something that I feel like a lot of projects, once they reach kind of a certain point. I think what's nice about Lord of the Rings, for example, is that while I'm sure there's a lot of sort of extended lore, both pre and post the Silmarillion, and then also, you know, the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and then The Hobbit. Those books that he wrote, and then also, you know, his son obviously wrote a lot of some of the stuff. Those are mostly all that there is in terms of real canon, and I feel like that's to its benefit, because once you get to the certain point where there's just thousands upon thousands of things, and different people are constantly retconning what other people have done, and then there's so much shit that you've expanded out into that the IP just becomes too inundated with nonsense. And so I feel like that's happened to all of them. It's happened to Star Wars, it happens to comic book things. And it waters down the experience in general. Even if you kind of have a general feeling of praise towards those particular IPs, I think as a sort of concise package, they fall short in a lot of ways. And so that's why I tend to sort of criticize them a lot. Star Wars seems so vastly overrated to me, given what it is. And then also, it just seems so, I don't know, it's so bloated at this point that I'm not really sure.
Sure. I mean, I definitely agree with that point. I won't go into it too far, but the reason that I like Star Wars is not necessarily because of the science fiction pull, because we've talked about this before, Star Wars is not science fiction, it's science fantasy.
Right.
But what I like about it is that, I mean, the universe is far-fetched, and the technology is not possible, but I like it because, first of all, the core story, I mean, the fact that it's built on the hero's journey and the characters and just the places you go and the things you interact with. You know, I did originally watch them as a young child, and a lot of times that can have some nostalgic effect on you, but I still very much enjoy watching it now. I mean, I feel like I would enjoy it just as much now if I was just introduced to it.
I think the original trilogy are good films.
I feel like that all the different crazy things in the universe were introduced to serve the story. You know, it's like, oh, we need to, because I think that's what Lucas originally said was the purpose of Lightspeed. I mean, we need to get from one point to another point really quickly for the sake of, you know, the plot.
Right.
Let's just have him jump in Lightspeed. And he said that he was amazed whenever they used that, you know, the special effects of the light kind of like streaking past, like we just used that to get from point A to point B, but he was amazed that people responded to it as ardently as they did back, you know, in the 70s.
Right.
That's just an example of, you know, he knew the story he wanted to tell, and he was going to build. Whenever you build a science fantasy world, you pretty much have free rein to create whatever kind of technology you want.
I mean, that's what fantasy is. You just make shit up, and yeah. as long as the audience is familiar with the rules of this, you know, make believe sort of universe, then it doesn't matter that it's made up. You just have to make sure that your rules A, stay consistent, and B, are known. Because if things just happen just for no reason without any kind of context, then it's kind of like, what's going on?
Right.
Like,
yeah, I mean, I do not like where the Force has gone. The Force has become...
Well, no, I mean, midichlorians and stuff is terrible.
What a terrible... The Force in the original trilogy, the rules by which it operated, I liked a lot. Like, it was not just you can pick someone up and just absolutely, you know, just crush them and tear them apart. But, you know, it had some nuance to it. Like, you couldn't just pull the romp. Like, that's what the dark side was. The dark side was skipping straight to the power, and you could shoot lightning out of your hands. That was like the ultimate manifestation of this raw power. But, you know, if you were patient with it and you kind of learned how to kind of be, you know, get deeper into it, you could actually be more powerful, which is, you know, what, you know, that's what Yoda represented. And you know, there's kind of him being like small yet being extremely powerful.
Well, one of the things that's sort of indicative of that, and this might have been a result of sort of lack of ability to do things that he wanted to do. And I mean, that, you know, evidence for that is that the direction he took it with the newer trilogy rather than the original trilogy. But the original trilogy, Yoda's supposed to be the most powerful, you know, he's the most powerful Jedi or whatever. And the ultimate thing that he does is he lifts the X-Wing out of the swamp, right? Which is not particularly spectacular. Now, I mean, you could think about it, obviously, if some guy just on the street was able to do that with his mind, obviously that would be spectacular. But I mean, like, within context of the universe, it's not that spectacular. Whereas in the newer trilogy, people are they're like Yoda's fight with what's his name, Darth Sidious, where he's fucking throwing, you know, the whole Senate around, just the whole place, and it's just like, okay, well, now you've just gone Dragon Ball Z level stupid with it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that level was. I mean, I agree with you on the point. I feel like that you can be a little more flashy, for example, the fighting in Episode One was a little more acceptable because you're in like the prime of, you know, like they have academies that teach people, you know, how to fight like this and stuff like that. So I feel like you have more license to, you know, go batshit crazy with stuff like that. But no, I definitely see the point with that's what happened with the Force. You had to keep upping the ante to keep on making it interesting for all these new stories you're writing. Sure. And it just gets to a point where you can't build it up. You know, you can't keep building it up and it being equated with what it was equated with in the original trilogy. But that's enough Star Wars talk. We'll save that for if we do if we do that. I mean, I'm choosing to be optimistic.
I'm optimistic about it mostly because I feel like Disney fucking knows what they're doing. It's not they're not new to the game.
No.
They've been so deeply involved with actual production that there's enough evidence around to show that they know what they're doing. You know what I mean? They're not just like EA or anything where like once EA's name has been attached to a project, now it's a negative, right? It's like, oh god, like what's happened? Like, oh no. But instead if Disney's name is attached to something, then I think generally that's a positive indicator.
But you can already see what they've done. You've already seen their acquisition with Marvel,
right?
That, I mean, the Avengers. I mean, it was not a perfect movie, but it did well, and they did a good job of converging those characters into a movie that was, you know, well done. I mean, it had its problems, but it was well done in general. But I would equate if we're you mentioned EA, I was about to say it. I would equate Disney with Microsoft Game Studios. And I say that because Microsoft Game Studios is really the only games like big publisher that's coming to mind that doesn't fiddle with things too much. Sure. That knows the proper amount of hands off. Because I mean, you see it with a couple of things. You see that with the original Mass Effect game was published by Microsoft Game Studios, and you know you could see that in just the creativity in the different systems. And I mean, even though that 2 and 3 got better and more refined, you could see the focus narrowing as EA got a hold of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like Halo 4 is another good example of something where you have a brand, even though you had talented people working at this newly created 343 Studios, where, you know, they went out and they found people, you know, that were not, you know, not just rookie designers. But Halo 4 was the first game that 343 shipped. First game. And so, I mean, that takes a lot of trust on a publisher standpoint to hand over, you know, possibly, you know, the flagship title or franchise of the Xbox to a team that has yet to ship a game.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I feel like that, you know, I feel like that's an adequate comparison between the two studios.
Sure. I mean, I'm not as familiar with them, you know, as I probably maybe should be, but if you feel that's an accurate representation, then, you know.
I've never felt the EA syndrome with a game that I've played from Microsoft Game Studios.
Mm-hmm.
you know, I've never felt like – I felt like the development teams have been able to do generally what they've wanted to do with the game.
Mm.
You know, I don't know.
Speaking of Halo. Speaking of Halo.
I just finished watching Forward Onto Dawn here pretty recently. Forward Onto Dawn is this 5-episode web miniseries. 5 episodes, 20 minutes a piece. That's supposed to serve as sort of viral marketing and promotional material for Halo 4. And then also it gives you a little bit of, unless I'm mistaken, it's the storyline way back in the past of the Halo franchise, right? And then also, like...
Yeah, I mean, so the Halo...
Just leading
Halo,
up to the beginning of Halo 4 is, like, there's little snippets of it there kind of at
right.
the end.
Yeah. Okay. Halo Combat Evolved takes place in 2552, and the events of Halo, or Forward Unto Dawn, take place in, like, 2526.
Mm-hmm.
And First Contact with the Covenant was in 2525, so that was kind of, like, the very beginning of the Human Covenant War, and so these, you know, when the Covenant comes down, they, you know, the general military, you know, public has not seen these things before. They've tried to kind of keep it quiet.
Sure.
But yeah, but then the other part takes place right before Halo 4, in between Halo 3 and Halo 4, whenever Master Chief has been stranded on the Forward Unto Dawn, which is the ship that he's stranded on. But it also works into Forward Unto Dawn is used in many ways throughout the series. It's kind of in a motto for the people at this Corbulo Military Academy that the main character Tom Lasky is at. But it
so
also
I'm assuming Tom Lasky is a big deal in Halo 4.
Yeah, he's somewhere in between a major and minor character.
Hmm.
But he's a character that will be in play for the trilogy. Like he's a character for the long run. And he definitely, you know. He doesn't play a minor part in Halo 4, but
like,
I would...
Is he like Captain Anderson, essentially, is what you're saying?
Yeah, he's kind of like Captain Anderson. He's the second in command of this giant ship Infinity that gets wrapped up in the events of that Master Chief is in Halo 4.
I see.
And his role increases as the story moves on. And like in Spartan Ops. Spartan Ops is this co-op, this kind of weekly co-op mode in Halo 4, where they release everything in Halo 4 is tied, is unified within one narrative banner. You know, you have the campaign, you have the Spartan Ops, which that story takes place 6 months after Halo 4's campaign. Mm-hmm. And then even the multiplayer is fictionally present within the world. It's the Spartan 4s on board the ship Infinity, and it's like they're doing like exercise training. And so everything is existing within the same thing, his role increases in the story in the Spartan Ops. And the Spartan Ops releases like a new episode every week, and you get like 5 new playable co-op missions every week. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
but increases. Go ahead.
I thought Forward Onto Dawn was pretty good, especially for a, sort of a web series. A lot of web series tend to be bad. And it was really well done. The production values and stuff were understandably a little bit lax. Obviously, it's not, you know, the special effects and things were clearly done by somewhat more amateur groups and whatnot. But I think
for what it was,
they did an excellent job of knowing their weaknesses, and so not tending to focus on things that could avoid those. So when they didn't need to use special effects, they made sure not to. Which is really good. I wonder how much of it was done with actual effects, like the explosion things. I wonder how much was done with real effects, not computer generated stuff.
Sure, I'm sure a lot of stuff in the forest.
It seems like
probably blew stuff up.
Yeah, it seems like a decent amount of it was, you know, they're actually using physical things, which is.
And that's always the better way, in my opinion. If you can do it, like it's kind of like Lord of the Rings did it. If you can do it and not do it special effects, it's going to look better.
Sure.
It's like the original trilogy of Star Wars versus the new trilogy. It's like a lot of stuff in the older ones look better simply because they did it with you know, real material. Mm. I feel like that you're going to have nuances that you just can't perfectly meld.
Well, this is I for some reason I feel like I mentioned this in one episode, but what's nice about Lord of the Rings is that what a general kind of feeling that I think a lot of films have, and the reason they fuck up a lot when they use special effects, is that I think people use it too much as a crutch, where they're like, you know, here, we want to have this effect and this effect and this effect. You know, how are we going to do those sort of things? Oh, we can just use a computer generated for the most of it. Whereas movies that were older, right, if you think about, like, Star Wars, the time period, the original trilogy, computer-generated effects are not a thing. Like, you can't use them. And so when you want to make an effect in a movie, you actually have to think. You have to think about how to make it look good, rather than just being, you know, oh, well, we'll just make it on a computer. And so what Lord of the Rings does so brilliantly is that when they had to use special effects, they obviously did, but when they could make it realistic by using 100 extras to do one certain thing, or in using sort of camera tricks to make people look shorter than they actually are and things like that, that's why the movie looks so fucking good, because because that's actually how it looks. That's actually reality, what you're looking at. You know, it's just kind of masked a little bit with, you know, kind of illusions and things to make it different.
Right.
And so that's the correct use of special effects. It's not correct when it's done. I don't know, when you try to, when everything just ends up looking like fucking,
when the set is a green screen.
Sure.
Yeah. So I mean, you really don't have a whole lot of experience with, like, the narrative, the story of Halo.
I don't know. I don't know anything about Halo, really.
Yeah.
Master Chief's like a robot. Spoilers.
He's kind of a robot. He's an enhanced super soldier. That's,
yeah. Okay.
We'll get into it later. But the Master Chief gets criticized a lot for being a faceless, mindless character, mm-hmm. and he's really not. He has a lot more personality. I mean, he is a very stoic character, but he has a lot more personality than a lot of game characters.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like it's not thrown in your face. It's developed over a long time, and then. 4 is the most personal, emotionally stirring story that we've seen, and that's going to. I feel like the whole next trilogy of 4, 5, and 6 is going to be about the Chief discovering who he is beyond being a soldier, which is interesting because his whole life has him being a soldier.
Right.
He was. I don't know if you know. I mean, he was kidnapped as a child and kind of forcibly conscripted into this Spartan program, and so that's the only life he's ever known. So, I mean, I was asking about that because I was asking if you like what you thought about, you know, the story, and, you know, did it, obviously, you know, it was trying to be good in and of itself, but did it make you, at what level was it effective as a marketing tool? Like, at what level did it make you want to play Halo 4 or not play Halo 4?
Well, I think as far as playing Halo 4, I won't really know until I actually play it. But as has been expressed, I haven't been a huge fan of it sort of traditionally.
Right.
And because I wasn't a huge fan of the gameplay, the storyline and things, you know, that came, that sort of also died along with it, where it's like, I don't like this game. So I quit, like, before I really kind of get into it. Whereas Mass Effect hooked me before I had a chance to discredit it for the gameplay. So then, sure. I was like, okay, well, I'm already invested in the storyline, so I guess I'll have to keep playing this first one. And then, you know, it got better or whatever. So I have never given Halo much of a chance. But what was nice about Forward Unto Dawn is it made me very interested in the narrative. I'm not sure that I'm still interested in gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
I think I probably will still feel about it the way that I do currently, even after I play it. And that's not, I mean, that's just, you know, that's sort of, I think it'll end up being sort of a preference thing. Whereas used to, I disliked it because I was like, it's worse. Whereas now I feel like it's not, I don't think it's worse. I think it's just different from what I kind of want or expect.
Sure.
And so I doubt that Halo 4 will be that much different, from a gameplay perspective, but Forward Unto Dawn sort of showed me that there's more to it than sort of just the gameplay of it, which means I might be more interested in playing the game legitimately. Even if I have to kind of, you know, put up with not my preference in terms of gameplay and things like that, but
sure.
But the storyline might be interesting enough to keep me going, which is something I hadn't necessarily considered a possibility for the Halo franchise.
Right.
And I think Forward Unto Dawn did a pretty good job of it.
Would you, like, if they ended up making an actual, you know, theatrical Halo movie, would that be something that you would be interested in, or something,
sure,
that you would still?
Sure, sure. I'd, like,
that's,
I mean,
been in purgatory for way too long.
I mean, the problem with, well, yeah, just like the Warcraft movie and everything.
It's died several times. It's not going to happen in the near future. But
I mean, supposedly a Warcraft movie is happening. Supposedly Blizzard is doing that. Which,
right.
Blizzard has always been able to do cinematics fucking out of control good.
Oh, that's one thing I was going to say. Okay, this might be more for a topic.
Hopefully Chris Metzen doesn't write it, but you know, other than that.
the graphics in Halo 4 are pretty good.
Oh yeah.
And there is a prologue and an epilogue that are done in pre-rendered graphics. It skips right over the Uncanny Valley and goes to awesome. I was amazed at how there are moments in the epilogue, especially when I can't tell if I'm looking at reality or if I'm looking at a computer generated thing.
Really?
And part of that's because when I'm looking at the armor of Master Chief, which it's easier to do that over like human faces, but
right.
Even there are plenty of human faces in these pre-rendered cutscenes. Oh, the whole game doesn't have pre-rendered cutscenes, only the prologue and epilogue. Mm-hmm. But it's they're pretty amazing, and it's a testament to the graphics of the game is that a lot of times when you do stuff like that, there is a jarring. You're very jarred whenever you switch from those really, really good CG graphics to they're all CG graphics, but you know what I mean.
When you switch from pre-rendered to
in-game. There's normally a jar, and there's really not that. But, I mean, there is a difference, but it's not jarring, in my opinion, from the pre-rendered to the game. And I feel like a lot of stuff in the game. So I'm excited to see. I'm excited to see what your opinion of the game is.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested to see whether or not I think it's good.
So
because I'm sure, like I said, I'm sure that at this point I've kind of come around to the idea that I might have been just butthurt about it initially. so I'm sure it's fine, especially given the universal praise and credit that it receives and continued attention and things like that. Obviously, they're doing something correct.
Right. In my opinion, the campaign on Halo 4 is the best since the original. I have. And I mean, I'm not disappointed. So the gameplay, I never felt like I didn't feel like 2 and 3 ever eclipsed 1 in terms of gameplay, partially because of the weapons in 1. Mm-hmm. The weapons in 1 are grossly imbalanced. But that's what made the campaign fun, is you just had all these powerful weapons to use. Mm-hmm. But in 2 and 3, they pulled back and they made the weapons balanced for multiplayer. But I felt like the weapons weren't as fun to use.
Fucking multiplayer experiences. Ruining single-player experiences since their inception.
But I feel like that 4 has struck an amazing balance, where they give you a lot of really awesome weapons to use. You know, they bring back the power of automatic weapons in 2 and 3 did not have a lot of power to them.
Mm-hmm.
But they because and it's all about marksman weapons, you know, like having that mid-range, you know, pop, 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 pop. Traditionally, that's what's been, like, you know, the money makers in multiplayer in 2 and 3. Sure. But that I felt like they brought back that power and that good feeling in the campaign, but they've also carried over the balance to the multiplayer. So I'm impressed. But
good. I'm glad.
So that's a good. Do you have anything else to say about Forward Unto Dawn, or is that we're gonna call that a wrap?
No. I think what I'll say about Forward Unto Dawn, kind of as like a last thing. What's nice about I like that. Games are starting to use miniseries and sort of live action things as marketing material because it gives, I don't know. This is a little anecdote that I'd like to use is that, you know, I've always had this feeling that video games are better at being sort of narrative than they're given a lot of credit for. And I never really understood why it was that it seems like, you know, like parents and sort of the older generation, and then like Roger Ebert, you know, wrote that whole thing where he's like, "Oh, video games aren't art," and all that kind of bullshit. I never understood why they were like that in terms of their attitude, because it just doesn't make any fucking sense. Like how can you just blanket say something like that? Even if you don't like them, like I don't understand how you can be like, "Oh yeah, there's just you can't have a story," and I just never understood it. And then like at one point during some dinner conversation with my dad, this was several years ago. I had mentioned something about a video game doing something or whatever, and I was like, you know, why, you know, so when did you stop playing? Because I know that I asked him because he used to play like Space Invaders and things like that. I know he did. Yeah. So I asked him, like, you know, well, why'd you stop playing? He's just like, oh, you know, I just don't like video games in general. And I was like, well, they got a lot more, you know, they got a lot going on storyline wise and stuff. And he's just like, well, blowing up barrels and collecting coins, you know, it's not my thing. And it struck me. It was like, that's how a lot of people view video games. Like,
Right.
Like, when you say, you know, oh, Mass Effect 3 is a good story, people go, Mass Effect 3, what's that? And you're like, it's a video game. They're like, oh, okay, so blowing up barrels and collecting coins. Have a good storyline. That's in their head, that's what they do. And it's not, you know, that's obviously, you know, super simplistic or whatever, but that's why Roger Ebert doesn't like them. Because he's like, well, that's so, it's like Mario, so it sucks. Right? Like, you know, it's like, oh, you know, save the princess. So what, you know, how's that going to stack up to Citizen Kane or anything like that? And it wouldn't. but there's more to it. And so what I like about using web series and sort of television and film as a medium for marketing is, and I think Forward Onto Dawn does a brilliant thing where it's like Forward Onto Dawn showed me that there's more going on narratively with Halo than I had ever considered. And that's even for somebody who plays games and who knows that they're capable of it. But just watching Forward Onto Dawn, like, you could watch that even if you didn't play video games, and you'd be like, oh, this kind of, there's obviously a lot going on in the story that I'm, because Forward Onto Dawn doesn't really give you any details. For the most part, it's just like, hey, here's some characters, you know, they're kids and they're in an academy, and it's like, oh, there's an alien, oh, it's the Master Chief, you know, and then the story's over. But it shows you that there's a lot more going on to the story. And so then, it, you know, if people are watching it, they're kind of like, oh, I want to know more. You know, then they're like, oh, it's a video game. You know, that might sort of branch off into that. And so what I like about it is that it draws sort of parallels, right, where they're not so cut and dry anymore. It's not like, here's a movie, this is what movies are capable of. Here's a video game, this is what video games are capable of. They're much more simpatico than that. There's a lot more overlap than I think people give credit for. And so things like Forward Onto Dawn and different sort of live action trailers, and then video game movies once they become good, since they haven't ever been good, then I think that'll, you know, that'll be evidence to that. And I think it'll.
I said I was done, but I'm gonna say one more thing, just because we talked about just levels, like you said, like the Forward Onto Dawn didn't just, you know, do a whole lot of exposition. Like, these are the Covenant, these are called elites, and they do this. You know, I mean, it just kind of threw you into it. One thing that the Halo franchise has done a very good job of is that, In not even counting the novels, which are done very well and they add a lot to the universe, but you don't have to read them. Just like in the games, especially in Halo 3, but it lets you get into the story as much as you want to get into it.
Right.
You know, like, if you just play through, you know, you'll get the main story and that's great. But like, there, you can go off and explore, and you can find, you know, data logs and terminals and like all this extra information, you know, that you read, that gives you a lot of background into all these different characters and all this different stuff. And it's not as robust as, you know, a Mass Effect or a Deus Ex, because it's a first person shooter. It's designed to be an action game. But as far as first person shooters go, I mean, Halo has the deepest, you know, narrative threads that I've seen in a first person shooter game, that, you know, a strictly first person, that's what the game is. You know, it's not an RPG, it's not something, it is a first person shooter. But and I think that's one of the reasons why I like it a lot. I mean, I like the game mechanics, but it also, it does more than just, you know, satisfy a trigger finger.
Sure.
You know? So yeah.
So yeah, it looks good.
Yep. Next week is, as far as I know, I don't know how we're gonna break it up, but
It's probably just going to be all Halo 4 next week.
It's going to be dominated by Halo 4. We're going to be talking about that because that game came out last Tuesday, sometime this last week. But the kicker is that we're going to have a special guest join us to talk about Halo 4. Are we going to review his occupation?
No, man. Okay. No spoilers. No spoilers. We'll have to wait.
Yeah, but what if it draws him in?
It's not going to draw him in.
You never know. Okay, all right. So we...
There's a very special guest, at our first special guest, and
our first special guest.
As I think I mentioned maybe in our last episode, it's still a little weird because I feel like we would have built up maybe to this person that is our special guest rather than just going straight to it. So I kind of feel like, you know, hey, we're, you know, filmmakers just starting this podcast about filmmaking. Now here's George Lucas, right? It's kind of like, oh, okay, this is weird. Like maybe you should talk to a guy who's a film student first, and then maybe a guy who's a film student, you know, who's like a professor at a film school, and then maybe, you know, maybe then George Lucas. But instead it's just like, hey, we're just cutting right to the chase. So that's a good
expansion
thing.
Expansion pack, no buts about it.
Yeah, right, it's like expansion pack. We don't fuck around. Like, so, no, a special guest coming up, and it'll be good, and, you know, I'm excited.
Yeah. Okay, no, so just, that was...
Play Halo 4.
Eighth episode of Expansion Pack. That was the eighth episode of Expansion Pack.
Number eight.
Number eight. My name is Greg.
08.
0, 8.
Is it a big? I don't know.
The 8 can be big. The 0 can be, I don't know. My name's Greg Rogers.
Biggest we've ever been. My name's Owen Cook.
My name's Greg Rogers.
And my name...
Greg Rogers.
This is atrocious. This show is terrible. I can't believe any of you people still listen to this.